Boston, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Winter is still officially a few days away, but outdoor temperatures in Massachusetts are already frigid, and that's very bad news for the growing number of people in the state who are homeless. People fall into homelessness for all sorts of reasons, and families in particular are increasingly turning to shelters. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about homeless families, who they are, what's causing their homelessness, and what can be done to help them. But first, even though temperatures were in the single digits in some parts of this region last night, volunteers fanned out across Boston to try to get an accurate count of the number of homeless people on the streets and in shelters. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman went along for the City of Boston's 34th annual Boston Homeless Census and has this report.
It's 8 p.m., the lobby of Boston City Hall. Participants, who will soon take to the streets and count the homeless, move efficiently along a series of tables. By now, the city's annual homeless census is a well-honed process.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. If you've done this before or you're doing it for the first time, thank you. You get a number. You go down the escalator. You get a snack. It's a long night. Take two. And then you're going to look for your number, whatever your number is.
350 volunteers strong, they're a ragtag army, armed against the cold with coats, scarves, boots, hats, and gloves.
Yeah, I grew up in New Hampshire. I know how to dress for the cold.
Jim Green is director of Boston's Emergency Shelter Commission. It was created 34 years ago to conduct the city's annual homeless count. Green is a longtime census veteran.
On a night like this, our earnest hope is that we're going to see very few people out on the street. This is probably the coldest night I can remember in 25 years of doing the census.
For the past three nights, volunteers have been passing out flyers on the street, talking to the homeless, encouraging them to go to shelters so they can get counted.
The shelters are at capacity, but they will make room for any person in need. They will put them in the lobby, they will put them downstairs, but we're going to try to get everybody we can inside.
Last year, Boston census takers counted 6,900 homeless people, an increase of 5% from just the year before. By far, most are family members, says Emergency Shelter Director Jim Green, caught between two opposite realities, stagnant incomes and soaring housing costs.
There's a kind of a great divide in our society, and a lot of the homelessness we see among families is an issue of economics. People's incomes are far too low to afford the rents here, so without rental assistance and without a safety net, they're on the street.
Compared to other cities, Boston has very few people living on the streets, less than 200. The shelter system is large and well-organized, coordinated by city, state, and private groups. Census volunteers are given instructions on how to approach homeless people in shelters and unsheltered. Ann Quinn of the city's Department of Innovation and Technology hands out walkie-talkies so teams of volunteers can stay in touch.
We've got about 30 radios, and then we have four vans. So we're basically coordinating the vans to pick folks up or to bring food, gloves, hats, blankets, etc.
And this year, for the first time, teams will go out with a mobile phone app supplied by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. Nick Martin is with Boston's Public Health Department.
So HUD has developed a mobile point-in-time tool to allow census volunteers, like the ones in Boston, to be able to track their numbers and enter the data in real time.
This year, special attention is being focused to count those who served in the armed forces. Alicia Flanagan is a volunteer census taker. She's with the Coast Guard.
You know, I just look for any opportunity to give back to the community. As an active duty military personnel, you know, the community gives back so much to us and supports. It's the least that I can do. I mean, I'm not a native to Boston, so this is my nexus with the community.
Census takers will also try to get an accurate count of the high users of emergency services, or HUES, the relatively small number of homeless people who cycle through the system again and again in shelters, emergency rooms, and on the streets. Until a few years ago, Joe Muse was the highest user in Boston. Now, he lives in affordable housing in Brookline and has a full-time job as a shipping clerk. On this night, he's a volunteer helping count the homeless.
I was one of the ones that were out on the street, you know, at the Boston Common, sleeping on a grate, drinking alcohol. I had a lot of help to get to where I'm at now from the people at Pine Street Inn. There is hope. There is a way out.
Before heading out into the frigid night to count the city's homeless, volunteers get a pep talk from Mayor Tom Menino. He's made fighting homelessness one of his administration's top priorities and says the census is far more than just numbers.
Tonight's street count is about putting a face and a voice to the issues of homelessness. Much harder for people to attack safety nets when the policy has a human face, when you meet the people in need. We can't lose sight of the ultimate goal. The only way to combat homelessness is by more affordable housing options.
The air is crisp, the night clear. Thankfully, the wind chill doesn't drive the single-digit temperature even lower. There are still patches of snow from the weekend storm and the promise of more to come as groups of volunteers fan out across the city. Elizabeth Jackson, executive director of Bridge Over Troubled Water, says her team is looking for young homeless kids.
There'll be 18, 17. They could be 14 and 13-year-old kids here.
You're kidding?
Yeah, no.
How does that happen? What are they doing here?
We'll see. A lot of it has to do with either mental health, either it's easier to be out here than to be at home because it's not safe at home, so it's safer out here.
It's hard to believe.
Yeah, but it's the truth.
Within minutes, Jackson finds Frank Ruggiero shivering in a baseball cap and light coat down the block from Boston's old City Hall.
It's cold out and...
Where are you guys staying tonight?
Do you have a hat, Elizabeth?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Where are you guys staying tonight?
I have no idea. I never have any idea where I'm staying.
Do you want to
what?
For us to find you a space for you guys to stay at? We can
I think we can pretty much find one on our own.
Ruggiero is 42, says he's a Navy vet, lost his job and got hurt about 3 years ago and has been homeless on and off ever since.
I've only been living on the street for 2 months. Before that, I was in subsidized housing. I got evicted from, and I was there for about a year, but before that, I had been homeless again for about 2 months, and I was on the street again, and
Jesse.
So I've been staying wherever I can and trying to get my, act together, get my doctor's appointments and stuff.
Park Street Station is warm and welcome relief from the unrelenting cold. An off-key musician entertains the indifferent late-night riders on the T. The loss of a home is one thing, dignity something else entirely. A tossed buck into an empty instrument case is usually enough recognition, but tonight there's a question. You got a place to stay? Yeah, thanks, comes the reply. And for a brief moment, there's a connection.
That's WBUR's Bruce Gellerman. Last night's count includes everyone sleeping on the streets and in shelters. And here's a striking fact. The fastest growing segment of the state's homeless population is families. It's at an all-time high. Last month, on average, each night more than 4,000 families in Massachusetts had no place to sleep. We want to spend some time talking about what's driving that increase and what can be done to provide more housing and ultimately prevent homelessness for families. So we're joined now by Michael Goodman. He's chair of the Department of Public Policy at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth. And Mike, thanks for making the drive through the snow up from southeastern Mass. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Aaron Gorenstein. He's the state's undersecretary for housing and community development. Aaron, thanks to you too. Aaron, do we have you as well?
Yes, I'm right here.
Oh, great. And also Libby Hayes. She's the executive director of the Boston-based advocacy organization Homeless for Families. Homes for Families. Libby, hi to you too.
Hi.
And listeners, we'd like you to weigh in during this conversation in terms of what you think can be done to prevent homelessness among families, what kind of problems you've seen. If you've known anyone who has been housed for most of their lives and suddenly something happened and now they're not, we want to hear those stories. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Libby Hayes, I want to start with you because you went out last night on the annual homeless census. I think you've gone out for several years in a row.
Yes, and I'm still defrosting from last night.
It was very cold. What would you say struck you most about this year compared to last year, to the past years?
I think the striking thing every year really is the number of people that are out and the number of volunteers and how many people do this on a regular night. So, for example, there was a woman in my group who was a street outreach team, and she knew where the gentleman was going to be, knew he probably wouldn't go into shelter, knew what his needs were. And so there's that connection where Boston is so well organized and knows where people are. I do think the scary thing is every year, especially with my agency's focus on family homelessness, is that fear that we're going to find children on the street. And thankfully, not that I heard of. I don't think any of the groups found mothers and children out on the street, but there were two families that were placed early on in the census before this street went out by the Emergency Shelter Commission.
Do you feel like when you think about who you saw on the streets last night, it was noteworthy in terms of different kinds of people, larger numbers of people? Could you make that distinction?
It was probably about the same in smaller numbers because it was so cold out and there was so much effort in the nights before to get people in and into shelter. It really was. And the focus a lot last night was what can we do to get people in to get them out of the cold.
Right. And because it takes a while to gather all the counts done by the individual teams, it will take a few months, I think, before there's an actual tally. But again, we've seen homelessness among families in particular rising over the last few years. From your view as a housing advocate, why do you think that is for that demographic in particular?
I think Jim Green's really spoke to it in the segment earlier talking about the census, that gap between wages and rent. Used to, back in the 70s, when before we even had a family shelter system, a family could be poor and afford rent. You could find an apartment for rent for $300. That same apartment now is $1,400, and wages haven't kept up.
$1,400 if you're lucky. I mean,
if you're lucky.
Many apartments now are between $2,000 and $3,000.
Exactly. And wages, whether it's TFDC, Social Security, minimum wage job, low-income jobs, is just not enough. So a family working a minimum wage job in Massachusetts would have to work 120 hours a week to be able to afford that rent and take care of their children. So it really is that gap between wages and rent and a disinvestment in affordable housing and help from the on the federal level, and just not been able to keep pace with the number of families that are falling into poverty.
And Libby Hayes, give us a little profile of some of the families you work with, how they ended up homeless. What are their situations?
There's so many different situations. I will say the common thing that everyone has in common is the resiliency, the dedication to their children, how hard they work to provide a better future for their children. But we see a lot of families that are homeless as a result of domestic violence. We see families who were working, were in school, either got laid off, a medical emergency. And we see families that aged out of the foster care system, that don't have friends and family to turn, don't have family to turn to, have friends that are in similar situations of them. So it's a really such a big variety. We do see commonly it's young children. 50% of the families in shelter have children under the age of 5. So we see issues of daycare, not being able to afford daycare, not being able to afford rent, and really just an affordability issue. Families that want to work, want to go to school, and just can't afford to make it all work together.
And is there often really a sense of shock by families that have gotten to this point?
Yes. A lot of shock, a lot of fear, a lot of despair, but still that commitment to their children to keep working to get themselves over the hump and housed and successful.
Aaron Gorenstein, again, you are the Undersecretary for Housing and Community Development for the state. And there were recent state figures that show that the number of homeless has risen 14% since 2010. So last January, it was almost 20,000 people. And that's even though homelessness has been declining nationally. Why do you think Massachusetts is trending in the opposite direction of the national numbers?
Well, actually, the National Alliance to End Homelessness has reported an increase across the country just in recent months, which is when we experienced a spike. But earlier this year, we had a 30% reduction. So we're making very good progress, but over the summer months, the numbers went up significantly. I think there was a 70% increase. And we're really, it's all hands on deck to really work with every family, get them rehoused as quickly as possible, try and prevent the homelessness in the first place. And as Libby said, to create more permanent affordable housing, we're really focusing a lot on that as well.
You said a 70% increase over the summer?
Yeah.
That's enormous. Why would that have happened?
Well, I think it's all the reasons that people have stated, that both Jim and Libby, it's a combination of economic struggles that people are having, the rising rents, shortage of affordable apartments. And there's a common scenario, people who are doubled up and have exhausted all of their housing options, so then they have to come into emergency shelter. And the challenges of domestic violence, and then on top of all that, the federal budget cuts. So, all that converges. There's no single reason, but it's a combination of factors. But then when someone comes in to apply for shelter, we place every single family that's eligible immediately, make sure they're safe. And I think that's a testament to the city of Boston, the state of Massachusetts. We have very few people who are on the streets, as was indicated, because we've invested in a very extensive shelter system and then really trying to quickly rehouse people, get them back into the community and back on their feet.
Now, sometimes that shelter can be hotels or motels. I believe that that recently reached a record high, more than 2,100 statewide. And then last year, the state spent $46 million on putting families in hotels. So explain that to us, because I know there are people who think if you spend, say, $100 a night on a hotel, you've just spent $3,000 a month, you should be able to find an apartment for less than $3,000. How do you decide when you're doing a hotel, when you're going to some subsidized apartment?
So we have 2,100 emergency shelter beds, and when those are full, we then go to our overflow shelter system, which is the hotels and most motels. And virtually any other state, they don't have an overflow shelter system. So we have that safety net here. We're obligated to place families. It's the last resort that we use. We don't like having to do it because families have to stay in one room. There's no cooking facilities. But at least they have a roof over their head, they're safe, we are providing intensive services and outreach to them on a regular basis, and again, to rehouse them as quickly as possible. So certainly it's much more cost effective to invest in homeless prevention, which is what the governor is doing and why we've been able to help 3,000 families from becoming homeless over the past year, and then getting more housing options produced, creating more affordable options for families. And that's also what we're focused on.
Michael Goodman of UMass Dartmouth, from your perspective as a public policy pro, I'm interested in your thoughts on the motel as a sort of pressure release valve. You know, for example, if the state is spending $3,000 a month to put someone in a hotel, is that good economic sense given that maybe there's an apartment out there for $2,000?
I don't think it works quite that simply. I know the state has tried in recent years to shift away from that hotel-motel system to give people direct subsidies to allow them to buy housing on the or rent housing on the private market. But I think what you discover through those experiments is that the numbers of actual homeless families are dwarfed by the number of hidden homeless families. These are people who have found ways of staying outside of the shelter system and outside of the hotel-motel system by doubling up in existing housing units, staying with family, staying with friends. And when they see the opportunity for a subsidized housing opportunity, they jump at the chance. And so I think what happens is that we're stuck in the sense that we have this profound set of structural problems around economic opportunities, stagnant wages, labor market challenges that disproportionately disadvantaged low-income families. And I think what happened over the summer, perhaps, was some backsliding in the state labor market that might have led people who were just able to keep it together to have a difficult time finding a way to make ends meet. And so I think under the circumstances, given the state has is willing to guarantee housing for families, you know, we are a right-to-shelter state for families, I think that there aren't a lot of alternatives, especially with the federal government essentially taking a step back.
We want to continue this conversation. We have to take a brief break. Stay with us. We'll continue talking about the rise in homeless families in Massachusetts, what some of the solutions are. We're with Mike Goodman of UMass Dartmouth, Libby Hayes of Homes for Families, and Aaron Gorenstein, the Undersecretary for Housing and Community Development. And listeners, call us, tell us what you see as you look out on the homelessness landscape, what you think the solutions are in a state where rents are now between $2,000 and $3,000 a month for apartments. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're continuing our conversation about the homelessness problem among families in Massachusetts with Mike Goodman of UMass Dartmouth at the Public Policy Department there, Libby Hayes, Executive Director of Homes for Families, and Aaron Gorenstein, the state's Undersecretary for Housing and Community Development. And we have some callers on the line that I'd like to go to right away. One of these is David, who is calling from the South End. And David, your thoughts about the homelessness problem in the state, particularly among families, if you have that perspective.
Hi, Aaron. It's David from Chelmsford and the South End.
Hi, David.
There are two points I'd like to make. Number one is working for a housing authority. I think across the state, the number of dollars that we have for resident services or supportive service dollars to support homeless families that are coming into public housing are really, really small. And I would love to see a significant increase in the number of dollars for resident services to help preserve tenancies, because once they're evicted or the eviction process begins in public housing, unfortunately, we'll probably see them back in the shelter system. The second point I'd like to make is we've been hearing a number of reports that because we have such a strong shelter system, there are a number of families coming in from other states. And for me, it's almost like, you know, in these services.
David, we lost you for a minute. Could you pick that up? We lost you for a minute. You said, for me, it's almost like?
It's almost like we have such a strong system that we're attracting potentially other families that aren't able to identify resources from their home state.
People from other states who like the social service sort of system or net here in Massachusetts.
Yes. If they could comment on those two points.
Sure. Aaron Gorenstein, do you want to take that?
I agree with David about the need for support services. We are putting some funding out to provide such services to families, both in public housing, particularly around employment opportunities. And that's what we've really tried to focus on, is can we get more families into employment and training, and so they can increase their wages. That's the way to attain self-sufficiency. So very much focused on that. In terms of the out-of-state issue, it is true that we do see families coming from out of state. We have a residency requirement in our emergency shelter system, but you cannot impose a durational requirement such that, you know, you would have to live here for a certain period of time. So it is true that some families do come from out of state. We have not noticed an increase in that, but it is one of the facts that does exist.
Libby Hayes, there was a report recently from Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies showing that more than one in four renters in Massachusetts and nationally spend more than half their income on their housing. I think someone had said earlier the median in the state is somewhere between $1,250 a month and $1,400 for a two-bedroom. Of course, that factors in central Mass, where things are much lower, much, much higher here in the Boston area. I'm interested in your thoughts, Libby, and also yours, Mike Goodman, about what people do, particularly if there's a pressure for more affordable housing. How is that going to happen, particularly when landlords realize they can get much more than they could from a tenant with a subsidy, perhaps?
I think a big challenge is families are faced with really hard decisions every day. Do we spend this money on food? Do we pay rent? And then it really just shows how fragile a family's economic situation is. So we see the impact that's coming up on food stamps and some of the federal cuts, and that's taking money away from people that already don't have much money, and what's that going to do? And I think it really speaks to the administration has made a big investment in the Massachusetts Rental Voucher Program, which is a subsidy program that can help make that gap up. And we can see more landlords that are willing to work with the state, work with families to have that portion of the rent paid for by the state to have reliable income.
Is that a landlord who would get the market rate, just a portion of it?
They could get the market rent, a portion of it subsidized. It makes things easy. It's cheaper alternative than shelters and motels. It's better for the families, and it can help stabilize tenancies and landlords and communities.
I want to go to another caller. This is Jennifer calling from Maynard. And Jennifer, you're a guidance counselor?
Yes, I am.
And what's your experience with this?
Well, I have a student, well, actually two students at my school, and their family has been living at the Bedford Plaza Hotel for 2 years now. They just marked their two-year anniversary. And the family consists of four children and a mom.
2 years.
They've been living
2 years.
2 years. In the motel, one bedroom, two beds. They were provided a cube refrigerator, which I was able to replace with a half fridge. They have no cooking facilities. You know, the kids can't play outside. They can't. There's no recreational place in the hotel. There's a swimming pool there, but they charge the tenants, some ridiculous amount to swim in the pool. And the mom works full time. Gets those kids to school every morning within, 15 minutes of the bell ringing. She's driving them from Bedford to Maynard. She's not taking advantage of the transportation that the two towns could be providing her.
Huh.
It's just heartbreaking.
Jennifer, let's turn this over to Undersecretary Gorenstein. Would that be typical, atypical, for someone to have a two-year hotel stay?
It's very unusual. The average length of stay, particularly in the hotels and motels, is about 6 months. So people are moving through the system. They're getting a lot of help on housing search and placement. I can't speak to that family. Obviously, don't know who the caller is referring to, but it's someone, obviously, I'd like to follow up with and try and see if we can get her placed as quickly as possible. It should not take that long. But, you know, there are some long stayers in the system, and we have actually targeted some rental assistance. These are families who tend to have higher barriers to finding affordable housing, a number of different issues that it could be. And so that's why we want to offer them some extra help, and that's what we're doing now.
I want to go to another caller who brings up the minimum wage issue, and this is Brian, who's calling from Tewksbury. And, Brian, your thoughts on this.
Hi. I've heard a lot about raising, sort of increasing affordable housing available, but really when it comes down to it, it sounds like these people are working jobs and they need higher wages. So it seems like the simple solution that needs to be pushed through by the politicians is raising the minimum wage and probably also raising, bringing up union rights, you know, making it easier to unionize so we can push up wages in the state.
Brian, thanks for that. Mike Goodman, is it as simple as that?
I don't know if it's as simple as that, but certainly taking a hard look at the minimum wage needs to be part of the solution. In an era where there is no natural wage increase, especially at the low end, and effectively no inflation on the consumer market outside of housing, at least, in some parts energy, I think the fact that we're at $8 an hour with the purchasing power of 15 or 20 years ago is a problem. I don't think you can solve the problem simply by raising the minimum wage. We also need to develop more housing. We don't do as much of that as they do in other parts of the country. We have local control of land use and zoning regulations that are archaic, that prevent the market from responding. But I don't think there's getting around the fact that even with a better minimum wage, even with a more adequate supply of housing, we need more subsidies to help working families keep a roof over their head. And I think at the end of the day, that's going to require the federal government to step up.
We have many more callers that we won't be able to get to. I wish we could. But I do want to tell you, Undersecretary, that I think we've gotten numbers for the woman who called in about the person in the hotel for 2 years, which we can pass on to you.
I would appreciate that.
Absolutely. And in about the minute we have left, I want to turn to you, Libby Hayes. Are there programs that are working in other states, innovative programs that have helped solve homelessness that you wish we would adopt here in Massachusetts?
It's tough because I do think that Massachusetts is ahead of the bar, and there's some great innovative programs here that are doing work around workforce development that have great partnerships with employers that do a lot of work around trauma, around domestic violence issues that really support families. I just read an article yesterday about an encampment in Seattle for homeless children that were living in the woods in a school bus, picking them up by a chain link fence and living in an encampment there. So our motels are bad, but in retrospect, and looking at some other places.
Relatively speaking, it's
so
pretty worse.
There's great work that's being done here in Massachusetts and in different places across the country, and really some opportunities. I think right now the shelter programs are all really striving to add more capacity so they can provide more in-depth services.
I want to thank the three of you for talking about this. I wish we had more time. As I said, many callers who'd like to weigh in. We're sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I want to thank Michael Goodman, again, chair of the Department of Public Policy at the University of Massachusetts. It's Dartmouth, Libby Hayes, Executive Director of Homes for Families, and the state's Undersecretary for Housing and Community Development, Aaron Gorenstein. Thank you to all of you.
Thank you
for having me.